So two little things. One, logistics. Simply, I'm just going to carry on now and talk, give a Dharma talk. So if anybody wants to take a break and go to the bathroom, go at any point that you want to go. And the other thing I wanted to say, and could have said when I first started speaking, but thank you, that's nice, is I just really want to welcome everybody here. The Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, are for our well-being, regardless of anything, whoever we are, whatever we're carrying, whatever we've had in our lives, whatever we believe, whatever we worry about, whatever difficulties you may have had, everybody, this is applicable to anyone. This is the most inclusive thing. There's no, you don't have to qualify for anything in any way. It's not reserved for any particular group of any kind. Everybody's welcome. Glad you're all here. So, what I want to talk about tonight is also, for those of you who don't know, I'm sure you all know, but this is part of a weekend, and so we're practicing. So a couple of the actual meat and potatoes of this particular talk is what we're going to explore for the weekend. And I'm calling this talk, what shall I call it, the Dharma, how we need the Dharma in difficult times. Because what I want to not avoid is that these are quite dramatic times, particularly in your country at the moment. And so how does the Dharma, you know, which is probably part of the questions that some of you have had here, you know, how does having this meditation practice apply to right now? So the Dharma in troubled times. And there was a thing I must remember. I thought of this while sitting. I want to write it down. So when I get there. I remember to say. So does this seem like what you'd like to me to talk about? So, well, the first thing is, the Dharma, meaning the Dharma perspective, sorry, my hearing aids are falling out, aging ears, you know, and microphones don't go together. Okay. The Dharma, the teachings the Buddha gave, the practices that we do, the reason that they are valuable is that they change the way we think. They change our perception. Not about change it, but they deepen or broaden or open or widen, mature our perception. And so the times, you know, that the various troubles in times, the Dharma doesn't change the troubles. The Dharma allows us to be different with the troubles, whatever the troubles are. And so a Dharma view of the troubles, for instance, is the fact that the troubles we're in now are particular at the moment, these particular turbulent economic and political times, not just here, but around. But these particular ups and downs that we're having aren't, in the big scheme of things, which is the Dharma view, particularly troublesome. Who here has read the book Sapiens? Oh, really? That's amazing to me. It's one of these New York Times bestsellers. Sapiens, it's about Homo sapiens, human. It's brilliant, it's one of the popular TED Talks, but anyway, I just finished reading it a little while ago. Sort of a broad view of the history of the evolution of human beings, the society of humans, and why we've come to be so proliferant on the planet. And very brilliant explanations about things. But anyway, towards the end of the book, the author, let me see if I can remember his name, it's something Noah Harari. He talks about that actually, which I then subsequently did a little research about, so I can now say that I've read some of this, the times we're in are probably better than they have ever been. He's a historian, and a long-term historian, like a world historian. For instance, up until the last about 300 years, the numbers of humans on the planet was slowly growing, but very gradually, because the numbers of people who died off, often before birth or in birth or infancy and with all the various illnesses and stuff, mitigated the reproduction. And so the numbers weren't out of control at all, except now, since the last 300 years, when the growth of humans as numbers on the planet went like, because of modern science, because of immunizations, because of Florence Nightingale and washing our hands and, you know, various understandings, because of the ability to put pesticides on the land and grow huge amounts of food and, you know, all modern, very, very, very recent situations. And before that time, and even since that, even in the last recent times, here's a few statistics, just to validate these opinions. In the 1700s, 90 million First Nations people in North America died from smallpox, introduced from Europe, because it was in with the lifestyle of the Europeans and there was no immunity here. In the 1800s, 25% of the adult population of Europe died from smallpox. In 25 million people have died because of AIDS. This is not even in the history. I mean, this is like within all of our experience. In 1918, that's in 1 year, that will be 100 years. So it's still in this century, between 50 and 100 million people died, between 3 and 5% of the world population, from that flu, Spanish flu. There were 500 million people infected. Can you imagine? Can you imagine what we would be, how much we would be complaining and saying, we're really in troubled times. We've got 50 million people dying of flu. I mean, that would be big trouble. That's, illness. Famines. This was horrifying. When I read this, I couldn't believe what I was reading. I know about being English that in 1879, 1.5 million Irish people died of famine. But I also knew vaguely about that in China, in the Great Leap Forward, which was in, 1959 to 1961, they don't know, between 15 and 43 million people starved. But also in China, between 1810 and 1850, another 45 million died, and in 1860, another 60 million died. We're talking 60 million people dying. And then in 1907, another 25 million. I mean, it's mind-boggling. That's China. India. 11 million people died in 1789 in India, and in 1860, another 4.5 million, and so on. I mean, it's just between 7 and 10 million people in 1932. Some of us were born in 1932. There may be somebody here born in 1932. 7 to 10 million Ukrainians starved. On and on and on. In Russia, there have been incredible famines over the time. In India, unbelievable. About 45 million people in India since 1700 people have died of famine. Just of famine. So it goes on, not to depress us endlessly, but to put this in perspective. And then war, genocides, in our lifetimes. 1915, well, not quite our lifetimes, this is 100 years ago from now. It's not a long time ago. More than 1 million Armenians were killed. This is genocide. This isn't just war, this is deliberate genocide. We know about the Holocaust, 6 million, 1933. 3 and onwards, 6 million Jews we know about, but it's often not mentioned. 5 million more, Romanies, Slavs, disabled people, dissidents, homosexuals as well. That's right there. Cambodia, 1975, I remember hearing it in the news. 2 million people were killed deliberately and another 2 million starved. And these are the people who died, not the people who suffered. It doesn't include the numbers of everyone who didn't actually end up dying because of it, but were hungry or were, you know, attacked and so on and so on. We know about the natives here. African people. African people have been enslaved and killed by the million, the slave trade. Wasn't just slaves dying on plantations, it was people being killed before they even made it to the coast to make it onto the boat where they also died, and in massive, massive numbers, millions again, millions. So this is just to remind us that we human beings have a history of troubled times, and these are the very worst times, the very worst times. They say there were 13 million women died in Europe because they were being called witches. They were either burned or else they jumped off cliffs because they didn't want to be burned. Huge numbers. The Black Death, the plague in Europe, 1400, something like half of the population of the whole of Europe died in plague. Those were bad times. And then because people in general, not these, those are just the massive dramatic numbers, but you know, most families, only half the children they bore survived it to adulthood, for instance, you know. And then, you know, the life expectancy was shortened. It was only shortened because the average, so many people died of diseases and accidents. And, you know, you didn't get to set your broken leg. You're lucky if it got straightened out and things like that. You know, when they do archaeology digs, they talk about how this person must have lived with great pain because they had this kind of, you know, arthritic condition or something in their teeth. We don't have a lot of that. It doesn't apply. We fixed so much of these problems. So we've kind of been lulled into, it's basically privilege. We've been privileged to actually not have massive war. There's much less war, apparently, than used to be the case. We're aware of the problem, but we're not aware of the perspective that holds that problem, puts it in proportion. And so we are the privileged ones who then become lulled into the expectation that it's supposed to be perfect, and when it's not, we then are troubled. It's interesting to see, like when you're in the midst of really big troubles, our capacity for trouble grows. When we don't have so much trouble, when we have some, we really complain about it. That's the position of the privileged, and that's applying to us. It's an interesting thing of looking. And the thing about the Dharma view, the Dharma is trying to see what's really true and cut through what's our opinions, you know, what's our desires and our assumptions and our expectations and our complaints to what's really going on. And what's really going on is our times aren't as bad as they have been before in lots and lots of ways. So just that bigger perspective, it doesn't change the fact that there's trouble. And I'm not diminishing the trouble, but putting it in perspective, we can see that it's our upset that grows and fans the troubles. So that's one beginning. When we do encounter difficulties, however, what happens is we get upset. We get troubled, we are disturbed. When we're troubled, we get triggered into, partly in this case because we've been lulled into assuming and expecting it to be not that way. We want it to be fine. We've allowed ourselves to be convinced that it's supposed to be no trouble. But whoever actually said, I promised you a rose garden? The Buddha says, this life of ours, this human life of ours, is made up of what we call the eight vicissitudes. Anybody not heard of the eight vicissitudes? Pleasure, pain, loss, gain, praise, blame, fame, and ill repute, the opposite. These four opposites, the pleasant ones and the unpleasant ones. This is the reality of this life. In fact, somewhere else it said, as you've all heard, I'm sure, that this human realm, with its eight vicissitudes, not four, eight vicissitudes, is the best place for awakening, because if it were just the four negative vicissitudes, if it was nothing but endless trouble, we would be in a state of constant survival mode, anxiety, guardedness, defensiveness, you know, we'd be, and it's not possible to have the luxury of contemplation, of calm, of encouragement, to be able to actually have some wisdom, because you're just completely preoccupied with self-preservation. If, on the other hand, it were nothing but the heavenly realms, where everything is hunky-dory all the time, we would be lulled into being asleep, because there would be no reason to learn any great skills or learn how to deal with the challenging relatives or whatever the challenging politicians we might have to deal with. And so to have eight vicissitudes, the pleasant and the unpleasant in equal measure, which is really what it's like for us, in extreme cases it's the heavenly realms and in extreme cases it's the hell realms for people, human beings. But on the whole, we're in the middle territory. It's the perfect place for awakening. And so to wish it were not so is actually, in a way, it's not going to serve our awakening. It's going to serve our comfort. You know, it's going to lull us some more, but not necessarily deepen our abilities or grow our capacities to be able to handle life, real life, because even if it weren't these troubles, it would be other troubles. And even though we, with our wonderful Western science, have managed to immunize everybody, and there's now no more smallpox on the planet, which was unbelievable 100 years ago, even though there will still be things that will trouble us, inevitably. The eight vicissitudes are part of our deal here. And so it's interesting to look at how we tend to complain when it's not happening, and we think that somehow God's got it wrong, or there's been a mistake or something, because there's been something happened. Somebody's, you know, now sick, or somebody's had a diagnosis, or some accident's happened, or, you know, some shocking earthquake has occurred. This is inevitable. When we get upset, when we get triggered, when things are challenging and difficult, what happens is we wish it weren't so, we don't want it to be that way, we resist it, we struggle, and we get triggered into all kinds of negative thinking. We get scared, for instance, or we get angry, for instance. And look what's been happening politically. Look at the hate speech. Look at the hate, you know, that's been going on. I do read the news and read about some of your news, but it spills over into the world. There's much more of an atmosphere of aggression at the moment, as we all know. I have a cousin who lives in Outremont, which is one of the, excuse me, neighborhoods of Montreal. And recently, about 2 weeks ago or so, maybe a month ago, there was a sudden proliferation of swastikas being painted all over the neighborhood, because it's a Hasidic Jew center. It's a lot of, you know, it's a very concentrated area of Jewish people in that part of the town. And very rapidly, there was a huge proliferation of pink hearts painted on everything, which I thought was a sweet response. But that hasn't happened there before, you know. So it's being stirred up, and we all know there's many such actions going on and challenges going on. People are being stirred up because of when we're upset, we start becoming defended and then aggressive. So how does the Dharma help this? The Dharma can't help that things are going to go up and down, as I've said. But the Dharma doesn't try and fix the world. The Dharma is about our own state and what's going on inside us, and can help us not get triggered when it's challenging into then behaviors which are inappropriate, which are harmful, and so on, alienating, critical. And so having a Dharma perspective, having the deep perspective, is what enables us to access our bigger and wiser and kinder parts, because we all have those. That's all the Dharma is going to do. It's not going to change the state of the world. It can dramatically change the state of each one of us, our own hearts. One of the things that happens when we get triggered is we get anxious and so on, we can get critical, some people get blaming other people and aggression, all those things that can happen. But one of the things that happens is we, in the state of being upset, we have lost trust in life being okay. We start to doubt that it's okay. And when we doubt, we get into this like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what, you know, what's the best thing, what should we do? And doubt is one of the five hindrances. Are you all familiar with the five hindrances? You're all, I don't know who's here, so I don't know who's just come in off the street and is curious about what meditation is, or seems like you're all diehard meditators, so we all speak the same language, you don't have to explain. So doubt is a very important one of the hindrances to experience, and I actually want to talk about it on the retreat. Several years ago, I don't know how many years ago now, 8 years ago or something, long enough that I can't remember how long ago, I explored doubt in my own practice. I just wanted to know, in my own life, I wanted to get familiar with what it was, because it's kind of like, yeah, I think I know what doubt means, but I wanted to really get to understand it. And it was a fascinating, for about a year, I kind of really checked out when doubt was showing up. And I learned a lot and realized doubt is from a place where there isn't any trust, or there's less trust, or little trust in the unfolding of life, like in the next moment, in how I'm going to be, or what's going to happen. Doubt is a feeling of insecurity and uncertainty in how next to move. And it's there a ton of our experience, it's a ton of the time. When we are completely fine, in those moments, those awakened moments, those free moments, those moments where there's clarity, awareness, calm, kindness, openness, honesty, all the things that we want, how we want to be, there isn't a sense of needing to do anything about anything. I usually use the example sunset moments. So there's a sunset, a lovely sunset, you know. And in the moment that you're looking at the sunset, there's not, oh, I want to do something about the sunset arising. There isn't, well, some people, especially now, modern era, I have to get my phone and photograph it. I want to keep it. But what I mean by a sunset moment is the absence of needing to do anything, and the absence of wanting it to be better or different or longer, or the absence of even having to have a sense of self with which to do anything. That's all absent, because the moment of awe, even if it's a little moment of awe, takes us beyond the self concerns and I should do this and I must do that or don't know what I should do. That doesn't even arise in those moments. When those moments aren't available to us, doubt has snuck in. Because it's underneath, I want this, I want more of this, I want less of this, I'm not okay with this, I'm feeling slightly squirmy and dissatisfied, I just don't want to deal with this, which are the other four hindrances, there's doubt. Because I doubt that it's okay the way it is, so therefore I want this or don't want that, or I'm agitated by this, or tuning that out. Doubt is kind of the underlying force that motivates that feeling of being a separate being who has to do something. It's very sneaky. It's very, you can more easily recognize when I want something. You know, I'm wanting something, I'm not satisfied. Or when I dislike something and I'm aversive to something, or troubled by something, or resistant to something. We know, we can recognize it. When we're agitated, restless, we can recognize it. We know what it feels like. We just tune into the body and there it is. If we're feeling dull or shut down or weak, you know, we know what that's like to collapse. They're pretty accessible. Doubt's way sneakier. We don't recognize it's there without checking it out. And furthermore, doubt, when it shows up in us, it's convincing. It's believable. We think we're being really clever to doubt things. We think we're just like, oh, I don't know if that's such a good idea. So we think it's wisdom. It's called masquerading as wisdom. We need a certain amount of doubt. It's not a hindrance. You know, we need to not just say, oh, yes, I know everything about everything. Yeah, I'm absolutely certain, because that's a pretty narrow, fixed mind, that overconfidence, that rigid mind. We need an open, flexible, curious mind. We don't have to know everything. But when doubt causes a sense of me, a sense of, or particularly, I don't know what to do, or a feeling of hesitancy is the best word, and it's the, you know, in the translations, there isn't the conviction to take the next step or to say the next word, or we don't know, we're hung up, then we aren't trusting life. And when life is troublesome and times are upsetting us, that gets triggered. And that's what a lot of people, you know, a lot of what's going on in people, is that not true? This kind of like, oh my God, I don't know what... what is going on? So we get triggered easily when life is turbulent, and the Dharma can help settle us from being triggered. There's doubt, that's one way that the Dharma can give us some view, and we'll explore that over the weekend. We're going to tune into how we experience doubt so you can get to recognize it, because it's so sneaky and so hard to realize that it's here. The Dharma can say to us that when you're triggered into wanting it to be some other way, and you don't like it how it is, this is called the first and second of the Noble Truths. I struggle, there's dukkha, there's stress in my system when I want it to be different. First and second Noble Truth. It's completely, absolutely, there it is, right there. The very basic teaching the Buddha gave. As soon as I'm triggered by the upset and I see myself, oh, I don't want this. Bernie, where are you? Then I'm in the first and second Noble Truth and not in the third. And everything the Buddha's teaching is how to go from the first and second Noble Truth, which are conjoined twins, you know, there's struggle because I want it to be other than it is, to the third Noble Truth, which is like, I don't want it to be any other way. This is the way it is. And so there isn't the dukkha, there isn't the struggle. That's all of the Buddha, everything he teaches. That's this simple journey from 1 and 2 to 3. So what happens is we're able to utilize our wisdom that we grow through meditation to be able to say, instead of, oh no, to say, oh yes, this is what's happening now. This is the situation that's happening. There's many different ways that this can give us some calm. But be able to say, this is what's happening, yes. I read a very interesting thing, it's a very clever little pithy phrase the other month. We want to be able to accept what's happening. Well, accept is a tricky word. Do I accept what I think is wrong? Can I accept what I don't believe in? Can I accept? So it's not a matter of accepting behavior that's harmful behavior, or decisions that are mean decisions or causing distress. It's not accept making right what's wrong. What it means is accept in my awareness what's happening. And from that place, if I can say, this is what's happening, can I make space for the fact that this is what it's like now? This is what something's happened. When I can accept the reality of it, its very fact, then by the fact of accepting, I'm now, I'm not triggered. When we're not able to accept what's happening as happening, we're triggered into saying, oh no, this should be different, and then we're going to be the same. We're going to then be complaining and blaming and who knows what we're going to be doing and how unskillful it's going to be. But once we can say this is actually what's happening, the accepting settles us. Then we can choose what we want to do about it, which of course we're not going to not do things. We're going to say things and do things and act. But we want to pro-act rather than re-act. So we need to be able to say, yes, this is what's happening. Allow into our awareness, accept into our awareness let it come in as saying, oh yes, I am aware this is what's happening, then I can choose. So it's a subtle thing, but it's all the difference in the world. Once we can say, this is happening and it's troublesome to me, this is challenging or difficult, or I'm worried here, as soon as we can say that's the truth of it, yes, I'm actually worried about this, we are able then, in that, because it's in our consciousness then, we're able to, just by the saying of that, we're actually caring for ourselves being troubled. Suddenly we're befriending ourselves in our upset. Instead of unconsciously upset and trying to resist what's happening or blame it or criticize it or struggle against it, which is what happens when we get triggered. We lose consciousness, we just get triggered. And so the Dharma brings us into consciousness, that's what it means. Being knowingly with what's happening. This is what's happening, I accept that this is what's happening, and this is upsetting me, this is what's happening. Now it's all of a sudden my kind, see the tone of voice is different, now I care actually. This is a big deal here, or whatever it is we're saying. That's not triggered, that's not unwise, you know, behavior. To mitigate maybe doubt, worry, triggered behavior, negativity, all of that, the Dharma can help us invite wholesome states. Again, those of you know all these foundation teachings, the essential Dharma teachings. You know about the Eightfold Path, yes? Anybody not? Now everyone's going to be scared to say, oh, actually, I'm the one who doesn't. And in the Eightfold Path, the number 7 is wise effort. And just to be technical, wise effort is 4. 4 efforts. I'm sure, therefore, you all know these efforts. But those are the efforts where we invite wholesome states that aren't here into our awareness. We encourage them to stay. How to actually sustain wholesome states. We abandon unwholesome states which have arisen. And, that's 1, 2, and 3, we also prevent, as best we can, unwholesome states from arising. Those are active things we actually can do for ourselves. And one of the ways we can invite a wholesome state if it's not yet arisen, i.e. if we're doubting and we want to release the doubt and instead have trust, we can use our Dharma practice, which means our trained minds, to invite in the wholesome state of trusting, which is the opposite state of doubting. So now I want to explore trusting, which is also what we're going to do for the weekend. That's what practice will be about. So to trust, there's different words here. There's one of the ways the Buddha teaches this is the word faith, which is saddha, faith. Faith has got lots of history and lots of charge for lots of people, so I prefer the word trust. Like the opposite of the word doubt. And this is also very important in understanding the way the Buddha taught and how the Dharma works. As I've said before, the Dharma doesn't focus, the teachings don't focus on what's happening. They don't focus on the troubles or the not troubles. They don't focus on the events of life. The Dharma teaches, the Buddha taught, his teachings, the Dharma teach us that well-being, which is the whole point of practicing that he taught us, isn't about what's happening. These 8 vicissitudes, it's about how we are with them. And so, trusting, there are certain things we can trust, but the focus in trusting and doubting, there are certain things which engender doubting. We're actually looking at the experience of doubting, the experience of trusting. Your experiencing is your happiness, not the circumstances that brought it about, not even the circumstances that will help with wholesome states, which we can utilize to change our minds, as in the 4 efforts. It's about the experience itself. That's what the point of meditation is about, learning to be aware of our own experience as we're experiencing. Many times throughout the teachings, the Buddha talks about this, experienced by the wise. Something, experienced by the wise. This isn't hypothetical. This isn't informational. This is experienced by the wise to experience. So what does it feel like when we experience trusting as opposed to doubting? So when we're trusting, whatever, what would you think of when you think of trusting? We often think of trusting someone. So for instance, if we're going to trust someone, I trust my best friend to be my best friend. She's my good friend, she's there for me, she knows me, she understands me, she's reliably there, I can call her any time of the day or night. She's my best friend, I trust her. So use that as an example. Her name is Sarah, if you care. She's also English, if you care. We met and saw each other and were best friends instantaneously. It was one of those recognize each other kind of moments. When I think about my good friend and what it's like trusting, there's a peacefulness, there's a... nothing is disturbed in me. It's not like trusting is very easy to describe because it doesn't have much in the way of a quality, but it's an absence of all of the qualities that are there when you doubt. When you're doubting, don't think I should take a step on this ice, it's maybe a little bit too thin, maybe there's a your ditheriness, a dodginess, you're up on your toes a little bit, you're a little bit anxious, right? It's energetically tasteable. Trusting is this absence. Nothing to say, nothing to do, nothing. It doesn't trigger any kind of activity in there. Everything's gone quiet. It's a safety, stillness. It's like when we walk on solid ground. You walk on solid ground and you just walk. But when you start walking on mud or something, or possibly shifting sands, it's a little, you start the eyes start opening up, the anxiety starts to rise, you start to think a lot. The absence of that is trusting. We can actually access, we can help mitigate the doubting by focusing on what's trustworthy, focusing on the objects of trust, which can lead us to appreciate and make more conscious the state of trusting inside. One of the most obvious things is the solidness of the earth. One of the reasons why earthquakes are so traumatizing is because we assume that the earth is not supposed to move, you know. Oh, I just heard that song, "The Earth Moved Under My Feet." You can't say things like that in retreats because then people come, they say, "I've been singing that song for the last 3 days." Because the earth is reliable. And so we just step out confidently on it. Recently, of this bad weather, we were really hit with bad weather on Salt Spring, where I live, in the, you know, this last month, to the point that some of the lakes froze. We have lakes on Salt Spring. And so there was one, there's a fair-sized lake that froze enough for on one day people could skate on it. And I think of stepping out onto questionable, you know, is it deep, you know, and then some people would be really confident and they'd step out, they'd really trust the ice, and other people would be like really tentative on the edge of the shore. That I could just see the play of doubt and trust going on right in that physical activity like that. But it applies to all kinds of things we do, people, things we're going to say, decisions we're going to make, places we're going to go. Do we want to join this group of people, go into this gathering? Will it be okay? Will I be accepted? Will I feel alienated? Will it? And so on. We can see that. And when we feel confident, we relax, we trust. Another of the places where we can put our attention to help bring trusting or confidence and remove a sense of doubting, which we all do unconsciously, is nature. We go out into nature and we don't doubt nature. I mean, we might not like the you know, what's going on with the climate. It's getting a little bit weird. And sometimes that can actually bring up now, more currently, some sense of like, this isn't right. This isn't supposed to be that right. The long, dry summers bring a sense of doubt for me. They undermine that sense of trust. But on the whole, that's remarkable. Typically, when we go outside into nature out there, one of the reasons why, it isn't just because it's pretty or because it's got nice clean air, it's because it's trustworthy. We don't have to check it out. We don't have to wonder, you know. There is no doubting. It's just how it is. It's safe sort of thing. One of the, this just reminds me, the biggest tragedies, I've only heard of this within the last year, is children born and raised in urban centers with no access to nature have phobia about going into nature because that's where they think the bad guys are. That's like fear of it. And I've always lived in the country and I just think, what a terrible loss to not have that, which I've just referred to, that, you know, being outside and it gives us a sense of, the opposite gives a sense of trust. Our bodies, trust the body. If in doubt, trust your body. If in doubt about how you're feeling about something, your body will tell you. There was a program I saw the other night on the television, and it was, I didn't see much of it, I just glimpsed into it, but it was about body language, and that's always really fascinated me. Partly, I think, as some of you know, I practiced long ago now, 20 years ago it finished, but I, for 20 years before that, practiced as a midwife. And women in labor, remarkably uncommunicative. And so, you know, you had to learn, I had to learn how people were doing through their body language. And it's fascinating to me. It's always been fascinating to me. I love to be able to understand, especially now in the role I'm in, is meeting people and not having lots of time for long discussions about what's going on, but trying to, you know, meet and receive and understand people. And I'm always very interested in this. The body is, you know, it shows up where there's anxiety, where there's ease, where there's interest, where there's boredom, where there's judgments, you know, all of it. It's like you, in a flash, we're very, very attuned. We've learned to survive. We've learned an enormous amount of this ability to communicate with each other. I'm going to change tax and have to add this in here because it's really up for me these days. With people spending so much time on screens as a way of communicating, instead of communicating by that, I'm worried that people are going to lose the sensitivity. I don't know if it's possible to lose it. It's evolved for, like, you know, millions of years probably. But our capacity to read each other and be sensitive, when we spend so many hours and hours not doing that and just using letters to communicate with, I worry. That's one of the things I worry about with this, you know, rapidly changing era where we spend so much time on not actually directly communicating, especially in public spaces, because I, you know, if I travel, I go to airports and stuff, and I sometimes just want to make a huge big noise and just get everyone to put their phones down and just talk to each other. Or I go and sit deliberately and talk to people who don't have the phone, like one in 20 people I actually go and sit down beside because they're available. So, anyway, that's just a little aside I have, but I don't trust them. So our bodies, you know, how are we feeling? This is where we experience what we experience. This is what the Buddha is teaching. To experience trusting in your body, you can experience right in your body. You feel it in your heart. You feel it in the way your shoulders are. You feel it in the set of your jaw, you know, how you're frowning. You can really, if you don't already know, your body will show you. If you don't understand what's going on with someone else, their body will show you a lot. So they're trustworthy things, ways to access what's really true. Our own experience, when we meditate, it's not someone's teaching, someone else's idea, something that we would like. Your own experience is what you completely can trust. What makes sense to you. You may hear teachings, you may put them into practice, but when you experience it for yourself, that's, you know, that's true. You know, when you have your own insight, when something comes clear for you, the lights go on and you recognize something, you know. I could come along and say, no, that's not true. And you know perfectly well it is true because it's your experience. That's the kind of trusting. There's no doubt there. The reason I'm talking about this is when we get triggered, we forget that. And we can actually remind ourselves by remembering what it is we trust. The seasons changing. I love things like, this is the season where I live, And I drove here today, so I drove past a big municipal dump area at one point, that like landfill thing. There were so many eagles. The eagles come back to my part of the world at this time of year, and then they mate and they reproduce. And then they later in the year, at the end, like after about September, for 2 or 3 or 4 months, they go up north. And then they come back in springtime, and then they go through it again, and they were back by the hundreds. I was driving through them. That gives me a joy, but it also reassures. It gives that confidence. So your breath can do the same thing. The reason that we use the word refuge, that your Dharma practice is a refuge, how is the Dharma a refuge? It doesn't mean a refuge from the ups and downs of life. They're always going to be going up and down. It's not a protection from troubles. It's a protection from being triggered by the troubles. It's the protection of your own state rather than, you know, we don't want to be free from the world. We want to be free in the world, with the world. So the refuge is from our own inappropriate thinking, from our own anxieties, from our own hindrances. The Dharma protects us from, inappropriate reactivity. Because it's from the smallness of our minds, the survival part of our minds. I often think of it nowadays. I say this a lot because the other book I read, but it was a year ago, and I'm sure I would have mentioned it when I was here last year, if any of you were here when I was here last year, because it's another book I just read that was brilliant also, The Master and His Emissary. Did anybody read that book? Well, I'm from another planet. That's a very intense book. Also a brilliant book. It's about another. I love the story of the human and how the human thinks. That's kind of what interests me, the human brain. The Master and His Emissary is another. It's a treatise, really. It's on the evolution of the human, but in terms of the hemispheres. The right and left hemispheres, the master being the right hemisphere and the emissary being the left hemisphere. Doing the job of the right, like going off and getting things done. But the mastery is the right hemisphere, the big knowing capacity. And I think when we meditate, we're developing the master, because the emissary is doing a fantastic job, in fact, too much of a good job. And we need to actually get back in touch with who's really running the show, what's really going on, the Dharma. And this particular book, The Master and His Emissary, is describing, again, the last 2,000 years of the civilizations, particularly the Western European civilization since the Greeks. So it was European history. He's a Scot who's writing it, Ian McGilchrist. But he's a historian, a philosopher, and but he's also a psychiatrist, and there's a lot of neuroimaging. It's all the recent research about how the brain functions. But in describing the evolution of the society, certain eras were predominantly right hemisphere and certain were left hemisphere. And he then, all through the book, is quoting the poets, the philosophers, what's going on politically at the time as examples of it. So it's extraordinary, fascinating book. Where was I? Why was I even beginning to speak about that? I can't remember what I was saying. Lost my thread. Got carried away with the details. But it's the Dharma is what's trying to access the big, quiet overview awareness. Whereas when we get triggered, either by positive things, but tonight I'm talking about troubles, the little part, the left hand, gets going and gets busy and loses touch with our wisdom. And the Dharma, the refuge of the Dharma, is to take a refuge from basically the left hemisphere's activity into the mastery of the wise part of our minds, which is our true nature, which we all have access to. But in the very beginning, when I was giving instructions for our sitting tonight, that part of ourselves is shy. Our wise, calm, clear understanding gets completely outshouted and overshadowed by all this stimulating concern, which gets triggered all the more by when times are triggering, when times are upsetting. So the Dharma is the salve. It's the peacemaker. It's the space maker. so we have the space to be able to see clearly what's going on without having to fall into wanting to fix it all the time. The Dharma view allows us to see not just from a big perspective, put things in perspective for us, which it does. It also allows us to see, for instance, that I love this phrase, Sylvia Boorstein's phrase, things may be awful, but they're lawful. It's a clever phrase. I'm sure many of you have heard of it. We're able to perceive through this bigger part of our minds, when they're functioning, when we've accessed them, we've calmed down the noisy little reacting part, we're able to see the conditions that were part of why this is the way it is. When something's happening, we don't just see it as a random event, or a random person, or you know, random word, or a random executive order. We're able to see that it actually, it's there because of all of this and this and this and this was went to make it up. When we can really, really appreciate conditionality in anything we see, we don't argue with it. We don't say, how could that be? We know very well how it could be. It's like this way, it could not be this way, when we realize the inevitability of conditionality. But when we can't see conditionality, we just see the event or the word or the thing the person said or the person. And we don't see them in their matrix, and therefore we just get triggered by them. The Dharma allows us to see the whole matrix, to see how things arise in these ways and what they're turning into. And when that's happening, we are able to accept it in our awareness. This makes sense. It may be awful, but it's completely sensible, you know, in lawful, you know, in that kind of technical way. That's from being able to have this bigger view, from being calm enough. So yeah, the Dharma helps us in our responding. It helps us in our capacity to be with whatever it is. The whatever it is, it doesn't help. It's going to be whatever it is, because life is going to keep on being whatever it is, all these things. Another thing I would say that we can notice because of our meditation practice that helps mitigate doubting and any of the other hindrances that arise from that separate sense of me that gets triggered, that gets busy, that left hemisphere activity, is when we get, and we have to see this over and over, and we get it more and more and more and more deeply, as you all know, your insights, you understand something and then you re-understand something more, and then you really get it, and it's like, I already knew this, but I didn't really know it, and now I really know it. It drops in like that, our understandings deepen, is seeing that everything's going to change. I know it sounds so simple, anicca, but it's life-changing once we really, this isn't it. This isn't the way it's always going to be. This is temporary. Everything's going to become something else. It's the most, without being able to access belief in change, we're stuck with this immediate situation. It feels so solid. That's utterly essential. Conditionality, anicca, perspective. Then one more thing to having a Dharma practice helps us access to benefit, mitigate our getting triggered, is this capacity of awareness itself, our own true nature. This, of all things, is the most trustworthy. We always, when we remember, and it's a matter of remembering, which is why mindfulness is called sati. One of the translations for the word sati is to remember that this shy master of our brain is always there, sitting in the sidelines, being outshouted, being covered up by our other things, our hindrances. But that capacity to be aware is always, always available. Awareness itself. It's the most trustworthy thing we have. All the emotions we have are going to come and go and change and not be that reliable. Certainly all the thoughts we have and the ideas we have and the opinions we have and the reactions we get, none of that is that reliable. It's always going to keep shifting and changing. You know, you have an argument, you meet somebody, they have an idea, you suddenly have a different idea now, and we're all the time evolving and shifting and changing. Awareness is untouchable. Awareness is awareness. Quietly, shyly, always, always available. And soon as it's accessible, in any moment you know, you wake up to that moment of being present and there's the knowing capacity, your awareness is there, it's like, ah, oh, there it is again. Always. Utterly, utterly reliable. From that place we can make sense. From that place we can make choice. From that place we can choose to be kind. From that place, once that's available, we can decide, oh yes, I trust these things, I don't trust these things. We're suddenly in... Again, we're the mastery over our lives. Without that awareness, we're victims of life. We're victims of circumstance, we're victims of our neurosis, victims of our anxiety. None of which are that reliable. Don't trust your opinions. Don't certainly trust their opinions, but don't trust your opinions. Yeah. That's all I think I have to say right now. Thank you for your attention. So I'd like to hear from you. I'd like you to ask questions. I'd like you to... I won't necessarily trust your opinions, but I want to hear them. Whatever this may have evoked in you, I want to know if this was useful for you. I hope it was. Anna.
And we couldn't call each other and text each other and say, here I am. And so what ended up happening was everyone had to put their devices away and everyone had to march with whoever was around them. And that was what everyone did. But it was very surprising to me to see it happen. But when the capacity to act from our habits was taken away, another thing happened all by itself.
And what was that? Could you all hear it? Germaine speaks so clearly, thank you. And what you didn't say, but what I want to know then, is when that happened and you had to just march with whoever was with you, what was it like?
It was wonderful.
That's what I wanted to hear you say.
It was what made the experience amazing. Everywhere you turned, the people who you saw were with you.
Were with you. Because you weren't all in your own little talking to your friend.
Yes.
Absolutely right. Thank you for sharing that. How lovely. I was teaching a retreat at that time, so I was having us do walking meditation in solidarity with whoever was watching. It's the best we could do. Please, your name?
Oh, Tama.
Pamela? Nice.
Doing these trust phrases, and I noticed that the anxieties and the tension and everything does go away when I do that, when I click in.
Right. Thank you.
I guess it's just a comment.
Thank you. Yes. So I'll repeat it because I'm not sure if everyone can hear everyone. So Cam was saying that she's been actually doing this. She's been saying trust phrases to herself as a practice, and in her walking meditations and in her hiking, and really has found that it does really does allay some of the anxiety. It's, yeah, not just a good idea, it's effective. Yay. Yeah, great. I'm curious, can you offer a couple of those phrases? Whatever little statements you make.
So one of them is, God for me is a shortcut for interconnectedness. So may I trust God with love.
May I trust God with love. God meaning interconnectedness. May I trust God with love.
May I trust myself with
May I trust myself with kindness. Beautiful.
May I trust others with willingness.
May I trust others with willingness.
And may I trust the process with action.
May I trust the process
with action.
With action. Beautiful. Thank you so much. Beautiful. Maybe someone else will find them useful. Hi. Your name?
Reggie.
I'm sorry.
Reggie.
Reggie, that's right.
I understand and I know and feel and I'm aware that things will change. And I sense that I know that, especially in these particularly turbulent times, as you call it. My deep concern, though, is that how much damage could be done before they change. And that's where I tend to get stuck.
So Reggie tends to get stuck with, she knows times will change, but until there has been a significant difference, what about the harm that will have been caused and damage in the meantime? Are you asking me a question?
No,
you're making a comment, because I feel like making a comment. The challenge of, the uncertainty of that and harm coming and pain arising. One of the things I use my own meditation practice in this way is that's an unanswerable question, and we don't know what will happen in the meantime, and that's it comes from that place of fear, or anxiety, doubt, whatever the words are, but fear that it's going to be a problem, it's going to be pain for people, and there's two things there. One is entertaining the fears. Can numb me and not, I can't help. But the other side of that is I can care. It's because I care. And I know that I care. And whenever I see whatever may be, whatever pain may be, whatever damage may be happening, whether it's this particular one that I don't know what it may be, or on anyone, I care. And I want to tune into my care. And it's from that caring and being open and available and not narrowed down in my little own bubble, that I will be proactive, that I will respond in a way that's helpful. And I want to rely on that, strengthen that, and commit myself to caring. And so that's a way of using the wise efforts with the concerns. I mean, it's not that the concerns shouldn't be there, it's reasonable, but because we don't know, it's an imponderable, what will happen, we can't anticipate necessarily. But when whatever happens, happens, whatever that may be, to my body, to my, somebody's broken heart, I want to care about that and respond to that. So that's one answer I would say. The difficulty of trying to imagine what may, when it's going to be a negative thing, doesn't in fact help. To be alert and to be caring is one thing, but to be freaked out or bothered by or stuck when nothing, there isn't anything you can actually do about any of that is actually not helpful. And it saps your energy. But to say, I want to notice and I want to be aware when things are happening so I can then respond. So keep awake without being a deer in front of the headlights is what you described. That's why I use the word stuck. And that's what fear does. Fear is very primal, and it stupefies the brain. So we don't know what to do. It's like, oh, deer in front of the headlights. It's stupefying. So entertaining fear isn't helpful, but being available and ready to and caring is. So the flip side of anxiety is care. And so let that be in your consciousness, that it matters to you, and you want to be there for a situation that would be difficult for whoever, whenever you encounter it. So that, because the theory just gets us spinning and tends to trigger us away from being clear and away from our mastery of our wise. So that's the difficulty of it. So to entertain what then just causes to spin isn't useful. It gets us stuck, as you say, which, is undermining in our general energy, and therefore we're not so available to be useful.
I guess maybe the word rather than just stuff would be concern.
Yeah, yeah.
Just
yeah.
How painful it is.
Yeah, yeah. And we need to feel that. Yeah, we need to be okay with feeling that. Yeah. I must say, it's the weirdest thing, but because of all of these times right now, I've never been around so much engagement. Like, you know, everybody is so stimulated, and it's like everyone's, you know, this is what really matters, and that's, there's been a lot of connecting over it. So, whereas we're not in our little sort of lulled stupor, everything's fine, la la la. Hi.
Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Jenny.
Along those lines, and you did mention, you know, you watch the news, and around watching the news, I find that right now I feel like I really need to be paying attention to what's going on. And on the other hand, it's really hard for me to walk, like, just even seeing this person. And also, like, as like learning about Buddhism and compassion and kindness, and even for who I call my enemies, even though I don't want to use that term, and that hurt people, like how to resolve that, you know, like having compassion, but also like,
yes, 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 that's exact. Could you all hear Jennifer? Shall I repeat? So Jennifer was like trying to grapple with, you know, as and she was referring to getting to know Buddhist practice, how to grapple with compassion and understanding and friendliness with somebody and situations that part of her says, no, 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 this is wrong, wrong, wrong. How do you balance these two things? What is that compassion? And so, I mean, this is really important, and I think we need to all get familiar with what this means. It is, if we can, we need a sense of balance. We need some calm and stability. When we have some calm in the mind, some trusting going on, whatever we can find, so that we're in a state that's not upset state, you know, to get to a place of okayness. Then when we look at what's challenging and difficult, we're able to say, this isn't right behavior, this is troublesome, this is dangerous, this is risky, this is separatist, this is alienation, whatever it may be. So we can be clear, we want to be able to discriminate right from wrong. But we want to be able to do it from a place that's grounded and calm and clear, rather than from a place that's triggered. From the place that it's triggered, we're doing the same thing. We're just being on the other side of the same, we're enemies, making enemies with enemies, and that doesn't help anyone, and it's got no future, and it's not freeing. So to be able to access some understanding about a situation, to have some compassion, we have to understand, we have to see clearly. Compassion is friendliness, metta, when things are difficult or where there's pain. It's the second of the four Brahmaviharas the Buddha taught, which are metta, friendliness, compassion when it's painful, difficult, appreciative joy when it's beautiful and wonderful, and equanimity. Those are the four Brahmaviharas or heavenly abodes. Excuse me. So when we're with in a situation that's challenging, to compassion isn't so much an action, it's nothing that we do, it's a capacity to stay open and respecting and caring when there's difficulty. That's all it means. It's a capacity. It's a quiet thing. When you're with somebody who's sick, as an example, compassion. I always use this as an example. You go to visit somebody in hospital who's really quite in distress and quite sick. The really compassionate visitor is quiet. You don't go like, oh, you'll be over to this tomorrow, you know, it'll be fine. Or you don't go like, oh my God, this is awful. Like, you know, why, who can we sue? And why didn't they diagnose this sooner? You just go, oh, this is really hard. I really feel for you. I just want you to know I'm right here loving you. There's nothing about the problem that there's no point reacting to it. There's no, you're not trying to make nice, you're not trying to fix, pretend it isn't there, be freaked out about it. Oh my God, this is terrible. You're just kind of like, yeah, this is hard. It's quiet, it's a capacity. And so with this situation, this is a conditioned reality. This is, if you had been born, whatever her name was, Marion somebody, the Scottish woman, you know, and that German father, and you had had that diet of food, and you'd had that diet of people, and you'd had that life, you would make the same decisions and say the same things and have the same opinions. It's a conditioned situation. When, you know, we need to have that calm of our meditation practice, clarity, walk in nature, trusting phrases, whatever, with which we then look towards the things which are upsetting us so that we don't get triggered into a limited form of upset. We can then be proactive and say, this is not right. I don't agree with this. When this is going on, I'm going to go to that demonstration. I'm going to stand up and be counted. I'm going to write my petitions or whatever we're going to choose to do from a place that's like, this is not acceptable behavior. Rather than like, how dare you, which is the caught up small response. So we need to have the groundedness of our meditation practice, because it's easier to do when we aren't being triggered. As soon as we're being triggered, we forget that, and then we're causing the same problem. This one story I've said so many times, but it's a fantastic example of this, and so I always tell it. And it was some Western people were in the Dharmasala visiting with the Dalai Lama and having a meeting together, several people, when a messenger arrived and came into the room and told the Dalai Lama that there was a recently arrived group of people, Tibetans, who'd just fled across the mountains, and this was their story, and some of them had escaped from prison, and they had been tortured and all of this, and some horrible dramas, and so they just delivered this news, so that he now knew there were a bunch of people he was going to go and visit next. And he cried. Just quietly cried. But he had all these Westerners there, so then he spoke to the Westerners and he said to them, so I don't know what he said, I don't remember, and I wasn't there, something about my friends, the enemy. And he explained that his tears, of course, were for the victims who had just been fleeing, and to flee across mountain ranges itself is desperate enough, but to have been tortured for a long time. His tears were more for the people, human beings, who could be so cruel, because he was so sad that their hearts were so closed, and he was able to cry, and he called them my friends, the enemy. So he wasn't in any triggered state around this news. He was able to accept into his awareness and into his heart that this is what was happening, and these people had done this to these people. But he hadn't put his heart, he hadn't closed against any of them. He just was in distress that it could happen this way. And from that place of being grounded, I mean, he's such an example and we all know him, but he's such a wise human being, he could do whatever he could do to be helpful, which might be to say that's not okay to torture people, you know, and give care to the victims. But it's remaining clear, open with the truth of what's happening, and then choosing a skillful response. So the point of our practice is to access the master of our wise hemisphere, so we then can hold and receive and respond and not get triggered into any other negative behavior. That's the whole thing. Whatever the thing is that's happening, it's not about that. It's about this state, accessing this state. From the littlest thing with, you know, fighting with your brother to dealing with, you know, world affairs, it's like, it doesn't matter what the thing is, it's we want that state so we can meet our life, these eight vicissitudes, without causing more harm. That's how it works. Good luck. We all need it. I mean, you know, we all need it anyway with anything, now and anywhere else. But you can see how it's easy to get triggered, and that's not useful. And there's no blame to do it to it, but it just isn't useful. It doesn't work. Hello.
Anne.
Yeah.
And people being triggered in troubled times, I thought, oh, she's saying that no
Wherever, sorry, the last thing?
Whoever drew the swastika
yeah.
was triggered.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mine too.
Absolutely. Now look at your, you know what she's just doing? I have to just say this to those of you who aren't looking. As she's saying this with your hands. I mean, I was talking about body language.
Yeah.
This is the universal, I believe, this is my opinion, this is the universal hand mudra for equanimity. It's like, this is how it is. This is an act of God. This is, these people are triggered. And that's why they go around like putting swastikas on the, you know, on people's cars and whatever, front doors. You have accepted into your reality that people get triggered and do unskillful things when they're triggered. That's right. You are too, but that's right. Exactly. I expect that President Trump has been triggered. We're all getting triggered all the time. But when we act from that place, it's our small, separate sense of self and its anxiety that hurts other people. As soon as we access the master, the sage of ourselves, our true nature, there isn't that stuff, that fear, that we're not triggered. And then we're able to have some compassion. We're able to listen. We're able to understand where they're coming from, where you're coming from, where I'm coming from. We're able to possibly then have some cooperation. That's the end of war. And it's only possible from that place. Because of the other little place, it's not. It just isn't wise enough. That's why we have to meditating, you know, whatever troubles. I have no idea what happened, but I think I was responsible. Accept my apologies. I just put my hair out. Please.
I love what you said about trust and the quietness of it.
Yeah.
And the absence of anxiety or stress. That I hadn't thought of it that way.
That's right. Thank you. But it's also the same description for nirvana, the same description for awakening. An awakened state isn't bells and whistles and choirs of angels. It's not remarkable. It's missed most of the time because it's so shy. It's just the absence of, I need to do something about something. First and second noble truth, I get going and I want and I worry and I fix and I complain. And when that stops happening and the sun is setting and it's beautiful, it's ordinary, but there's just freedom from all of the other disturbance. It's exactly the same thing. Same thing for any of the wholesome states. They're unremarkable. What's remarkable is all the neurosis, because we can describe them all because they're so activating and we know what those all do to us and we can feel it all. And when it lets go, in any moment you have any kind of insight, it lets go and then it's just like, there's freedom, there's relief, there's quiet, there's like, oh. Suddenly there's presence, suddenly there's knowing, suddenly there's caring. But they're not remarkable because they're not any, they don't have features. That's the whole teaching of the Buddha, is for that, for us to experience that increasingly. Nice note to end the evening. So thank you, everybody, for your attention. We have a couple of other things to say. Before we get there, just one moment, briefly, is I like us to have this little reflection, which is that exploring the Dharma together, practicing together, reflecting, being quiet, affects us. It transforms something even a little bit energetically. But that doesn't just stick with us. We're not isolated beings. We are not in plastic bags. We're not islands. Anything that affects any one of us affects everyone else around us because we're little generators of energy. And so our practicing together, our being together is a gift. It's our gift to the world because whether we want to or not, everyone's going to benefit that we meet. We'll be a little nicer to the bus conductor or to the person at the door or the person selling us coffee or whatever it is, they will be benefiting. It's going to happen whether you want it to or not, but let's make that conscious. Let's dedicate our evening so that we know we are doing this for more well-being all around, everywhere, whomever, however. May there be lots of benefit from our being here together tonight. Thanks.